This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 15th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. We're going tropical this week with a special edition dedicated to Brazilian design and architecture. Coming up today, I meet the man who has been responsible for bringing the best of Brazilian design, old and new, to the masses in the US and in the UK.
It's a very creative country, you know, and it's a very inspiring country, and I think the new generation, it's coming strong.
Monocle's Sao Paulo correspondent Sheena Rossiter pays a visit to the beautiful modernist home of legendary Brazilian architect Lina Bobardi.
We have some 57,000 drawings, 15,000 pictures, and many works of art that remains of the art collection of the couple.
And once we've finished our caipirinhas, we'll be swapping one theme for another. We'll be venturing a little further afield to two film festivals dedicated to movies about the medium of architecture. The first in New York and the second in Rotterdam.
I combined these two disciplines and I realized that in film you can tell what's behind the wall. And therefore it's such a wonderful layer to architecture.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To head up this week's special on Brazilian design, we meet the man who has been responsible for bringing the contemporary crop of creatives to the rest of the world. Carlos Junguera is the founder of Espaço, a showroom with outposts in New York, Los Angeles and London, dedicated to selling furniture and artwork from the Brazilian subcontinent. Espaço deals works by everyone from mid-century greats such as Joaquim Tenreiro and José Zenina Caldas, as well as current practitioners including Issei Wainfield and the Campana brothers. We caught up with Carlos at 100% Design during London Design Festival a couple of weeks ago to discuss Brazil's special place on the global stage.
Whoever is fan of design know about Sergio, know about Tenreiro, know about, of course, Niemeyer, but... The contemporary ones that it's coming now, people are still getting to know them, you know, and enjoying them, because I think the group of designers that we are bringing to this through Espaço represents the culture of Brazil. You have so many different cultures in one place, and when you go to a place like this, you see that they are so different from each other, the pieces, which represent each one personality. And when you put all together, it's fun, it's, you know, it's interesting. They connect to each other. Like, it's totally like the way Brazil is as a country.
I mean, it's hard to generalize, but what sets Brazilian design apart? I mean, there's sort of certain frivolity to it, isn't there? A different use of materials, obviously different types of wood used.
I think it's the variety of woods, the materials. We are a very rich country in woods, and a good part of this work that we are doing is showing that having so much wood can be used in a very sustainable way, you know, as the designers don't, you know, some of the pieces when we don't challenge the nature and we control, they're very aware of what woods they can make it and how they can make it. So I think one thing that makes Brazil a little bit different from others is the different woods. It's not dark wood, as you just said. It's all those different grains and different types, but with a very careful approach to the protection of the wood. All of these are sustainably correct, you know, yeah. Which I think it's what it matters.
And obviously on the stand here, it's got the real sort of the greats of Brazilian design. But what's sort of industry and design like for a young Brazilian designer sort of coming up at the moment?
I think there is a very interesting group of young designers coming out. They are still, it's still new to Brazil, the great exposure of Brazilian design. This is Although Sergio Rodriguez designed furniture since 1950s, the awareness of Brazilian design is pretty globally. It's a very young. You know, when I started this business, nobody had a clue who was Sergio Rodriguez or Joaquim Tenreiro. Niemeyer, of course, everybody was in everybody's mind, but besides Niemeyer, nobody has the information. And I think it's new for the old generation, the exposure. Can you imagine the new generation who is coming, how they're approaching? But I think there is a big, it's a very creative country, you know, and it's a very inspiring country. And I think people who want the new generation, it's coming strong.
And why is London sort of important on the sort of global map as a place to present Brazilian design?
Because we have the gallery in New York, and a lot of people from Europe was visiting, and the interest for the collection was very big. So I decided that I always want to be on this part of the globe, and I think London is in London you get people that not necessarily goes to US to shop, and it's exactly what's happening. And also they feel like if we have a outpost, if we have a presence in London, they feel like more safe, that yes, they are serious, not just for Americans but in Europe also. And when they are going to buy something that it's expensive, it's very expensive, the furniture, and they know that we have a gallery in London, they feel like it's totally okay then to buy it.
That was Carlos Junguera, founder of Brazilian design showroom Espaço, talking to me there. From one showroom to another, we head to Toronto's Avenue Road. Earlier this month, a Canadian furniture dealership helped host the event For You from Brazil, an evening at the newly opened Soho House Toronto dedicated to Brazilian design. Guests included designer Carlos Motta, as well as Etel and Lisa Carmona, owners and designers of Etel Interiores, the prestigious Brazilian design collective and manufacturer. Monocle's Toronto bureau chief Nelly Gochiva went along to the event and chatted with the special guests who had made the trip north.
Stefan, you have four Brazilian designers that participate in this project. How did you pick them? Why this specific designers?
I did initially an exhibit in Toronto 5 years ago to introduce Brazilian design to Toronto. And at the time, I was the only one, I think I still am the only one, showing Brazilian modern design in Canada. And the first one was sort of a general introduction, showing a little bit of, to get a flavor of Brazilian design. The second time around, I wanted to go a little deeper and tell stories, Brazilian stories. And I picked initially three, then it became four designers with very different backgrounds, very different philosophies, very different personalities, and very different from very different time periods of Brazil, of the last century, to showcase here in Toronto. And I was very intrigued by them. You know, like we have Oscar Niemeyer, you know, the architectural icon. We have Paulo Werneck, the beautiful mosaic artist and designer. We have Georges Salzopin, the modernist furniture designer from the 50s and 60s. And we have Carlos Motta, which has a very unique, wonderful approach to design. And all four of them, I think, as a cross-reference of Brazilian design, they all show different aspects of Brazilian furniture design.
Where do you find your affinity for Brazilian design, and why Brazilian design specifically?
I saw a few pieces by Tenreiro in a gallery in New York about maybe 10 years ago. And I just loved the tonality, the wood, the language, the mix of a little bit of Scandinavian influence, mid-century, but at the same time a very tropical flavor, unique woods, and a very, you know, unique design language. At the time, there was, as I said, there was nothing in Canada available of that style. There was a lot of Italian designers, a lot of European designers in general, some North American designers. So I felt there was a niche and do something different and show Toronto and our audience something that is truly unique and different.
Carlos, do you think that Canadian audience is ready for Brazilian design?
Oh, I hope so. You know, because the Brazilian design is very, it's unique in a way, but so simple, very easy to observe, to understand. And most of the pieces that are here are very utilitarian. So it's not that you have a concept that is complicated, you know. So I'm in what Avenue Row did to put these pieces together. It would be easier for the people in Toronto or in Canada to understand better what the Brazilian design means.
And Stefan, a question for you, because you also have a showroom in New York. Do you think that American consumers are more prepared or more informed when it comes to Brazilian design?
I think so, because they were more exposed to it. There's a wonderful gallery in New York that has been representing Brazilian design for a long time, even before we existed. I think there were also different exhibits or auction houses that sold Brazilian design before. Here in Toronto, we definitely had to do some groundwork. And I remember the reactions of the first exhibit. People were really intrigued, yet not, you know, didn't know what to do with it. And I think that the challenge for us is also, I mean, we have a very specific climate that's very different than Brazil. You know, we have winters, we have the seasons, you know, we're anything but tropical. So how do you make that work? And also from a commercial perspective, how does that translate? So that was for us a bit of a learning curve as well. But I think people stepped away from it, looking at it as something a very tropical, exotic product, and really envisioning and seeing that those pieces actually work in their environments. And that took some time, but I think we're getting there, and I'm really excited now to do this the second time around, especially with Carlos.
And Carlos, a similar question to you. How is Brazilian design accepted internationally, not just in Canada, but out of Brazil?
Well, I believe that now we are in a better position because we don't have a big tradition in design in Brazil. Different from other areas like architecture, we have a very strong work, worldwide known in fashion, in food, in music, but the design was kind of hided, you know. It took a while to spread a little bit, and it's a very new thing in Brazil. We don't have a long tradition. For myself, I believe that the Brazilian design is from the last 60 years, because it really starts when Sérgio Rodrigues, in my opinion, when Sérgio Rodrigues, that is very Brazilian, designed the, they call cadeira mole, is something that express the way we are. We are very laid back, you know. You sit down in this chair, very spread, like the Brazilians do, because it's hot, it's tropical, it's sensual. So when Sérgio Rodrigues did that chair in the 50s, I believe that that's the very strong beginning of the Brazilian design, because we have a lot of designers in Brazil, but they came like Jewish Europeans that came to Brazil. They know how to make furniture. They're really good. They add a lot to Brazilian furniture history, but they don't have a Brazilian soul, in the meaning that they didn't grow there. So they don't know the name of the wood. They don't even know how to spell the name of the wood, because it's very typical from the Brazilian Indians. But they add a lot. Like Zalzupin is a person that is completely mixed with us in Brazil. He had a lot. He taught a lot for us. But the deep soul from the Brazilian design for myself start with Sérgio Rodrigues. So it's a very short story. But anyway, we are people like in the last 20 or 30 years start spread a little bit. In the last 10 years, really accelerate. And what Avenue Road is doing is something with a lot of courage to understand and to put in the market the Brazilian design, because design is very similar everywhere, but there's some little tricky from culture, and sometimes it's enough to people take a while to understand. But now is a good time for Brazil, is a very good moment.
That was Nelly Gochiva reporting from Avenue Road's For You from Brazil event there. Coming up, Monocle's Sheena Rossiter hits the streets of Sao Paulo to pay a visit to the glass home of legendary Brazilian architect Lina Bobardi.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Sao Paulo is known for its seemingly never-ending skyline of concrete high-rises. But in the middle of the upscale neighbourhood Morumbi, architecture aficionados can find the Glass House. It was the home of the legendary Sao Paulo-based architect Lina Bobardi, and it now acts as a museum of her life and career. The 7,000 square metre property is a modernist work that houses archives of her and her husband Pietro's life, including his extensive art collection. Monocle correspondent Sheena Roster was invited to the Glass House to take a glimpse into the illuminating life of Lina Bobardi.
Tucked away behind unwelcoming gates, most passers-by, as they cruise by in their cars, probably don't know how much of the city's design history sits on the other side of the fence. Lina Bobardi's Glass House appears to be just like any other here in the Morumbi neighborhood. From the street, tall and intimidating gates keep intruders out, and the plaque, which indicates it's a museum, remains discreet. But as the gates open, the Glass House, or Casa do Vidro in Portuguese, reveals itself, defined by its modernist straight lines and floor-to-ceiling panes of glass. Myself, along with a select group of visitors invited by the Iguatemi group, are taken around the property.
Watch out, watch the steps. It's there.
A professor at the University of Sao Paulo, Renato Anelli, is the director of the Lina Bobardi Institute. He takes us around and down to her studio. He knows the ins and outs of this house. He did his PhD in Italy specifically about Italian artists who came to Brazil, like Lina Bobardi. He explains that really, they created the modernist movement here in Brazil, despite not actually being Brazilian.
Italian artists who came to Brazil and were the, how you say, the pioneers of the Brazilian modern architecture here in Sao Paulo, the first generation in the 20s, and the second generation after the Second War.
Bobardi came to Brazil from Rome in 1946, just as many other Italians did during the post-war years. But Brazil made her creativity blossom, and she remains well known as one of the leaders in the country's modernist movement. Admittedly, Sao Paulo was not her first choice to live in Brazil. She preferred Rio de Janeiro, but was lured to Sao Paulo when she was selected to design the city's iconic Sao Paulo Museum of Art, better known as MASP, which sits on the city's main street, Avenida Paulista.
The main entrance is over there.
A few years after MASP was finished, in 1951, Lina and her husband Pedro built the Glass House, the first residence in Morumbi, which was once the Mata Atlantica rainforest. The couple lived there until their deaths in the early and late 1990s. After that, Giuseppe Gabriel Dana, president of the Lina Bobardi Institute, decided to start the foundation in the couple's honor.
E ricordatevi nella visita che state facendo.
Italian and part of the post-war immigration himself, he identifies very much with Lina's work and was good friends with the couple.
Potete farci tutte le domande che volete. Siamo qui per...
I knew the couple very well, he says, but I learned even more about them after we started the institute.
Mettere a disposizione.
He adds that they are still organizing the archives after having the institute open for around a decade, but the archives are already quite extensive. Renato Anelli explains what has already been organized with the archive.
The archives are organized and online. We have all the drawings online in the website of the Institute. We have some 57,000 drawings, 15,000 pictures, 114 movies, and many works of art that remains of the art collection of the couple.
There was a hiccup with running the Glass House back in 2006, though. Because of the house's location in the middle of what was once a rainforest, natural elements have caused the stilted structure to erode faster than normal. 7 years ago, the Glass House had to be closed for 3 years for renovations. And because of the structure's delicate nature, visits to the Glass House can only be made by appointment and in groups no larger than 12 people. The only exception was this past April when Swiss curator Hans Urich hosted a 50-day exhibition at the house, which received around 10,000 visitors. Renato Anelli explains the main challenges the Institute has with maintaining the house.
We work with the preservation of the house. It is very tough to maintain this house because we have many difficult situations in the middle of these trees. This is really a rainforest garden, so the humidity here is very bad. Okay, let's go upstairs so we can show you the house.
As we head out of the remote studio, tucked away in the rainforest garden, we make our way up several sets of stairs to the living room, a vast open space that's flooded with natural life with its floor-to-ceiling windows. Here, we take a look at several of her sketches and furniture, which was designed by Lena herself.
It's nice, no? This was her bedroom.
Around the corner and down the hall, we head to her bedroom, one of the few rooms in the house that isn't full of the archives. But just like the living room, it's also full of furniture that she designed.
How would you describe her type of style here for the bed and tables?
How can I describe it? I think it's a kind of fun design in the first, in the beginning of her career. You can find this design in the illustrations of the magazines she designed.
As Renato takes us outside the house, behind the kitchen and into the back section of the seemingly never-ending garden, we overlook Sao Paulo's Faria Lima, a business district which surely didn't exist when Lena and Pedro built the house. But after touring around the 7,000 square meter property, it wouldn't be fair to call the glass house or Casa do Vidro a house, but rather a piece of design history which teaches all of those who visit not just about Brazil's history of modernist design, but also allows you to take a peek into the life of one of the great minds behind it, Lena Bobardi. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, for our weekly insight into a design studio on our radar, we take a trip to Rio de Janeiro. Sitting in the picture postcard neighbourhood of Lagoa, it's not hard to get inspired by the Tabaruba Design Studio's office. Run by a husband and wife team, the open-air office generates creativity with its homely feel. In fact, the office sits on top of the owner's house, which was designed by Bruno Lemgruber and Luciana Junguera. Bruno takes us through the Tabaruba office.
When we moved back from New York, back to Rio, we really were looking for something that felt really homey and comfortable. I think our approach to design is very much hands-on, and it's part of our life. We can't really separate it from a life from work, so we designed this space, from furniture to the space itself, in a way that we could enjoy the amount of light that we have in Rio. The computers, of course, are a big part of our lives. We try to be updated, and actually we are very fastidious on being on top of things technologically. Not only equipment, but software and techniques. But I started with books and paper and pencil, because everything we do, we make a big effort on starting from scratch and starting from the basics. I think the human hand is much faster than any machine, and it's much faster to express your ideas on pencil and paper. So we make not an effort, is actually part of our routine. Like, we start in pen and paper and pencil and paper, and we try to make sure that, like, they're always accessible in all tables. We all have our sketch pads beside our computers. Then we talk about ideas. Because we're an open space, we try to make short meetings to discuss ideas quickly, and then go back to implement or to evolve on them. Sometimes we spend some time each working on our own daily projects, but it's not uncommon that we have recurrent meetings throughout the day, exchanging ideas, and that's basically what we try to do. Be creative, let the freedom have its place and grow and take its path, but in the end, results, you need to show results. We surround ourselves with books. Definitely you can see here, half the walls in Tabaruba have books from top to bottom, or actually books and magazines. And pencils, paper, watercolor, music in the background always. Different musics, different styles. We go from the superstars like Marisa to Seu Jorge. But in the end, if you need to pick one music, we're probably going to say it's Nina Simone and Feeling Good, because in the end, if we don't work in design, because design is not a job, it's who we are, so we need to feel good. That's the whole thing about what we do.
Nina Simone's Feeling Good, chosen by Bruno Lem Gruber, designer of the Tabaruba office. Coming up next, we leave Brazil and visit two festivals celebrating both the design of buildings through the medium of film. But first, we're in Dublin at Ireland's Open House Festival, touring the 100 standout structures the city has to offer. A bus garage, a fruit and vegetable market, and a block of flats. Structures rarely praised or even acknowledged for their architectural excellence. However, this year's Open House Dublin, Ireland's largest architectural festival, celebrated both the obvious and overlooked buildings in the country's capital city. The festival, now in its eighth year, boasted a varied list of buildings from the President's House in Dublin's Phoenix Park to a roadside kiosk on the bank of the Grand Canal. 100 buildings were carefully chosen to delight and surprise the public by offering a unique insight into Dublin's architectural story. Monocle's Barbara Feeney went to Dublin to find out more.
It's an old party, a filled-in party, and the project began with problems. Right? They didn't walk away from them, and even back then, with, I would suggest, very limited resources, they came on board with it.
That's Dublin bus driver Billy Fleming describing the site of Donnybrook Bus Garage. The 1940s structure is the work of architect Michael Scott, who achieved international acclaim with the 1939 Irish Pavilion at the New York World Fair. The Donnybrook Bus Garage site is a former tram depot. At the time of its construction, structural engineering was in its infancy in Ireland, so the Irish Transport Authority appointed distinguished Danish engineer Ove Rupp to assist in the design and construction of the building.
Very little, if any, modification in all the years this building is here. Bit of patching up you see around the bits of infill. The red pipes are all fire suppression systems added later for insurance reasons, for buses parked inside and all the rest of it. It doesn't take away or make any difference to the essential structure of the building itself. Again, as I say to you, when you look at it initially, it's nothing, only a space, an absolute space, but it's an industrial space that is capable of great things if it's used rightly.
The Donnybrook Bus Garage is one of many buildings that featured in this year's Open House Dublin, Ireland's biggest architectural festival, which is now in its eighth year. The 2013 programme included 100 buildings, many of which are not usually accessible to the public. Both design buffs and the blissfully ignorant were able to enjoy architecture in all its dimensions. I went along to the Irish Architecture Foundation headquarters in Dublin to meet the director of the event.
My name is Nathalie Wadick. I'm director of the Irish Architecture Foundation, and we are the organisation who run the Open House Dublin project. It's the biggest festival of architecture in Ireland, and for us it is an important flagship project of our general annual programme because it is fantastic. Device or mechanism to create awareness about the cultural value of architecture. It's a fantastic device to generate audiences for architecture, and by this we mean audiences among the general public, not people who are already interested in architecture. It is not for architects, it's for the general public to suddenly to realize that their built environment is important to them.
The theme of the event plays an important role in the tough decision-making process. This year's theme included a broad selection of buildings, chosen to surprise and delight the public, as Natalie explains.
Our project this year, we've themed 100 great buildings from the Office of the Overlooked. And, you know, it's a really, really diverse programme. The earliest buildings are from the 17th century right up to 2013. And there are various different building types, from educational to residential to cultural, public, private, and so they really kind of show the diversity of architecture. And we really, this year we had focused on some younger architects as well. That's really important. So this year our theme, from the obvious to the overlooked, we wanted to really sort of dig deep behind the scenes and find the buildings that were the most overlooked. For instance, buildings that we use day to day but actually never consider them in relation to design. Donnybrook bus station is one of those. You know, people pass it every single day, never think about that. Oh, an architect designed that. And actually, that was a very innovative use of concrete. It was like, in terms of technology, that building is like far surpasses its years.
This is reflected during the tour of the 1940 structure. The construction of the shell roof at Donnybrook bus depot provided a RUP with invaluable experience that later assisted them in the design of the iconic shell roof at Sydney Opera House. Tour guide Billy Fleming explains further.
I think the first thing anybody should notice here is light. Immediately light. It's not a terribly bright day outside, but in the sunshine here, this place is naturally lit almost the entire length by the glass in the apex of the roof, which at the time of its design was a fairly, I'll say, mould-breaking experience, because that's what was used to pour the concrete into. This is mass concrete poured into moulds, okay? The garage itself was to be one of eight identical projects for the then new CIE. CIE was set up in 1945. It hit the ground running, and it's worth recalling that in 1945, 1946, we were every bit as bust as we are now, if not buster.
Some buildings attract more interest than others. But it is clear that the Irish public have a keen interest in many of the capital's older buildings, which tell a story about Dublin's rich cultural and social history.
There's always like a big interest in our Georgian heritage, which is completely understandable. That's why we have a very sort of diverse programme, and we, over the years, have tried to sort of push people out of their comfort zone of what they sort of can appreciate or can take in as architecture in the terms of their own interest and taste, and move them into sort of considering more of the contemporary buildings. And we've seen that trend happening. We've seen kind of a shift, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not older versus newer buildings. It's really, I don't think you can tell the story of contemporary architecture without looking at the older stuff.
There is much to learn from Dublin's varied architecture. But what was clear from this year's Open House Dublin programme is that the unnoticed and ordinary buildings can also possess great architectural charm. From the obvious to the overlooked, there is much to discover about Dublin's architectural story. For Monocle, in Dublin, I'm Barbara Feeney.
Coming up after the break on Section D, we'll find out what happens when movies meet architecture.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Architecture, a creative form intrinsic to our way of life, has perhaps, outside of the profession, remained esoteric and elitist to those looking in. Those eager to communicate the supposedly exciting new developments in the trade may look beyond preaching to the choir by conventional means and consider film as a tool to help spread the good word outside of the favoured circles. The Architecture and Design Film Festival in New York attempts to do just that. Beginning on October the 16th, this year's edition celebrates the work of architects and designers in over 30 films, from shorts to feature-length explorations of the creative processes of many leading practitioners. Section D producer Aled John caught up with architect and festival founder Kyle Bergman to find out why he thinks film is an appropriate medium for the discussion.
The megacity is a reality. And it looks a lot like the visions of science fiction films. Gigacities are soon to be. In the midst of this cold, bleak vision of the future, we have the human being. It is personal, warm, social.
We have actually a great opening night film, a Danish film called The Human Scale, about the work of Jan Gehl. And actually this year, the whole festival, there seemed to be a lot of films submitted that were about urbanism. And so we have this kind of, not because we created it, but just by what we selected, there's all these kind of interesting films on urban themes. And the Jan Gehl film is an amazing film, really looking at cities around the world. And Jan's got this, you know, he kind of says that we understand gorilla habitats better than human habitats. And just by looking at all how we deal with cities, there's a lot that we could do better. And he's been working on this for about 40 years, so it's really great that we have a film on him.
Looking at that curatorial process that you undergo as the founder of the festival, what went into it this year? Were there any specific themes which you wanted to broach? Was urban design the main focus for you and the team, or was it very much a fluid process?
It's totally a fluid process. We really can't pick ahead of time what's going to kind of rise to the top. We look at about almost 300 films each year getting ready for the festival, and we between shorts and feature-length films. And we don't go in with any kind of premeditated, like the festival is going to be about this or about that. We really look and see what's available and see what makes sense. And then we program the festival so it's has a diversity to it, a diversity of ideas. And we're also interested, you know, I'm an architect, but I started this really as a way to increase the design dialogue between the architectural community and non-design community. And so all the films that we choose, hopefully interesting to everyone across the board, anyone who's interested in design at all.
So the audience isn't primarily a designer or an architect or someone from that community. You are hoping to target the broader aspect of society, people on the whole who could be interested in design, or of course architecture is something that we all live in, so it's an important festival for everybody.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we do about 50% are design professionals, but 50% come from everything, and the common thread of people who are interested in design. And when I started the festival, what I really wanted to do is increase the design dialogue. And if we just, as architects or designers, if we just talk to ourselves, it's a lot less interesting. It's much, much more interesting to have a broader conversation and dialogue. And the great thing about a film or film festival is that, you know, anyone can sit down and watch a film for an hour and a half and then sit in a bar or cafe afterwards. And the discussions is really in between the films are really what makes the festival exciting and interesting. I mean, that's the amazing part. Of course, we could all watch films at home, but it's much more fun to kind of come out and talk about them. And so we always do the festival in a venue that has a cafe or bar connected to it. So that's really the exciting part.
Before we get onto the content of some of the films, I wonder if we could talk a moment about the connection you see between film and architecture, and why, when you founded the festival, this was an important sort of marriage between different mediums.
There are so many similarities. I mean, they're both storytelling. I mean, it's kind of more clear with film, but in architecture, every time we pick a material or make decisions, we're telling a story. And so they're really both narrative. It's really important. They're both about light and scale and proportion. They're both collaborative processes where you know, the architect or the director is really responsible for pulling a lot of different elements together, you know, and hopefully the structural engineer knows more than the architect, and the director of photography knows more than the director. So it's a generalist pulling together a number of experts. So there's so many connections between architecture and film.
And looking at some of the films then, you mentioned before that you're including the work of urban designers such as Jan Geyer, William White, architects such as Anthony Gaudi. I wonder if you can talk a moment about, I haven't seen the films, we haven't seen the movies just yet, the festival is right. About to begin. What is the format? Are they feature length? Are they short? Are they 10 minutes, 15 minutes? Yeah.
So a whole spectrum of lengths, anything between our shortest film this year is 2 minutes and the longest film is 96 minutes. And what we do is we put together programs of films that are about 90 minutes long that are somehow content connected in a certain way or they work together. And we program the feature length films first and then we bring the shorts and other films together to create a program. And they're all documentaries, but they're really, we pick films that have human stories and are dynamic stories that are, sometimes when we use the word documentaries in the States, people can turn people off. And so they're really films about the creative process.
Paul Smith has tended to change the style of clothes slightly. He's just given men a little better dress sense, which is rare from an English designer.
Very British. For me, wearing Paul Smith, it makes me happy. When I wear the clothes, I'm happy.
Great patterns, bright colors. Even though it's loads of flowers, it's great because it's kind of discreet because it's in the lining.
We have films on Paul Smith, the clothing designer, and it's really about his design process. Films on Tadao Ando, actually a really beautiful German film about Ando's work, and it's beautiful, minimalist, austere film that goes really well with Ando's architecture. And a new film on Paolo Solari, who died this year, an Italian architect who went to Arizona and started Arcosante, among other things. And that film is much more kind of like Solari. It has this little bit kind of groovier feeling, a little bit more kind of Southwest in a certain way feeling.
I think his legacy will be as an architectural futurist.
Paolo Solari planted the seed, you know, back in the 70s in my head, is how to have a connection between the natural environment and the built environment.
Even if I failed in applying this notion in developing a prototype or whatever, somebody is going to pick it up after me.
In your lifetime, you think?
It doesn't matter that much.
For you, the impetus for the festival, the birth of it was kind of the cause behind it was communication then. Providing a window into the practices and the kind of connecting processes between sort of inspiration to industrial, you know, manufacturing and then implementation, is it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I had thought about it for almost 5 years before I actually launched it. And, you know, what's great about film is you can tell stories about design that are richer than just still photography, I mean, or just text. And you can really talk about design in a way through film, if done right, that's really expansive. And the real goal is really, you know, to up the level of design conversation across the board. And, you know, that's good for us as professionals, but it's also good for society. And the goal of this is to learn a lot at the same time being entertained and having some fun. And film can be a really nice balance between those goals. And so far it's been working. It's been a lot of fun. We're in our fifth year now. We do it in New York, and we take this program to L.A. and then Chicago, and it's a lot of fun. People come and come back year after year. Once they get there, they realize how diverse, interesting, and fun.
Kyle Bergman, founder of the Architecture and Design Film Festival in New York. And you can tune in next week to hear from some of the directors showcasing their work at the festival. From New York, we head now to the Orange Country, the Netherlands. The Architecture Film Festival Rotterdam is a biannual festival that explores the relationship between film and architecture. Over the course of a long weekend in October, feature films and documentaries, shorts and animated videos are devoured by fans of the built environment and celluloid renditions of them. Monocle's Gillian de Bias sat down with the festival's founding director, Jord Den Hollander, to discuss this year's offering.
I mean, architects are musicians, poets, and everything, you know? And many architects I know don't just stick to architecture. Sometimes they do other things. And
filmmakers and architects are two very different disciplines, but they connect in a very palpable way.
Creative yet disciplined, creators of environments that touch the soul and stimulate the imagination, and yes, maybe even the inexplicable drive to discover utopia, there are many common denominators that unite the world of architecture and film. The Architecture Film Festival of Rotterdam highlights and explores this intellectual and creative alchemy. George von Hollander trained first as an architect, then as a filmmaker. So, as founder of the festival, he's the perfect person to talk to about the potential of film to power up discussion and stimulate debate on the micro and macro aspects of architecture today.
I combined these two disciplines, and I realized that in film you can tell what's behind the walls, and therefore it's such a wonderful layer to architecture. You can tell about the process, you can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects and the political things. And as filmmakers in essence are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can show a world that isn't as smooth as it seems from that iconic architecture, but you can tell what's behind the facade.
They laughed at me when I said I wanted a 100-story building. They said it wouldn't hold together. But I had the courage and the vision, and it's mine and I own it.
Ambition and obsession seem to be at least part of the DNA of each and every architect. And perhaps it's this real-life drama of human achievement and human failure that appeals to filmmakers.
These are exactly the aspects a good story writer is putting in his story. Ambition. Conflict, aspects about financing the things. And of course, from the point of view of architects, they're always obsessed with their profession. You have to be, because it's so complicated. But you're an artist, you want to express something and you want to make things more beautiful and cities more livable. So it's a very complicated profession. And in film, you can deduce that, you can analyze it, and you can make it understandable for a wider audience.
A UFO landed. People became inspired with optimism. Everybody happy. We never looked back. But there was a new threat, though we didn't care because we were socialists anyway. And we thought, let's demolish the leftovers. Because old ain't new. Everything changed so fast. And people weren't very happy. Because a good future means nothing without a past.
This year's festival theme was City as Time Machine. But interestingly, this wasn't just a nostalgic look at the past or a fictional look at the future. It turned out to be a very relevant way of exploring the present.
We're living in a very interesting time. Because of the crisis, we don't build anymore. Well, not as much as we did. We've had the past 20 years, as we call it, the golden age of building. Such an immense amount of volume has been built. And lots of people have made profit out of this. And suddenly it came to a stop. And financing these big projects wasn't possible anymore. We used to look at old buildings as when they had some quality or represented a certain age. We said, that's a monument. We got to preserve it because it's telling the stories of an old time. But now we look at the buildings in a more sustainable way. We invested money to build them, and you cannot tear them down and build something new. Those times of too much money to invest are over. So we have to think how we're going to use them, how we're going to make them meaningful. And what helps is the stories that are behind these buildings.
And Rotterdam is a perfect example of City as Time Machine. Bombed out beyond recognition in 1940, for the past 60 years, Rotterdam has been a living canvas for architects and urbanists from Holland and from around the world. This city is an ideal place to host a film festival with a special focus on architecture. And as a biennial festival, it allows ample time not just for new films to be made, but also for the industry to evolve. What changes and issues, I wondered, did this 2013 festival reflect?
When we started, people were focusing on the star architects. The films that were made were about the Fosters, the Zaha Hadids, the Kohas, and of course, still that kind of stardom attracts people. But more and more, the tendency is that filmmakers become interested in urban life, how urbanity has changed us. And if we can learn from other cities through films, I think it's very interesting. There will be a development towards that way of thinking. And then these kind of festivals will help people and decision makers and even architects and urban planners to think different about their cities.
At the end of a couple of full-on days at the festival, I left Rotterdam stimulated and inspired, but the filmmaker in me was left pondering the question, do architects make good filmmakers?
As for this moment, the films I've seen from architects aren't very good, but that doesn't matter. I mean, normally when an architect introduces his plans to his clients, sometimes they know how to speak, and we show some films like The Competition where they talk about their masterpieces. But sometimes they forget about human existence, about how people are gonna live. And that's what filmmakers are interested in. So will architects become good storytellers or good filmmakers? I would say I'm hesitating. I would say no. But therefore we need the filmmakers who are interested in all those aspects of architecture. And then they both will blend, finally.
So who are we? We are desperate people. Therefore, let's dive into our past to search for answers how to combine the old with the new. And on top of that, let's rebuild some old. And in the future, preserve the past. Because it's the only combination that will last.
Jord Den Hollander talking to our Gillian de Bias at this year's Architecture Film Festival Rotterdam there. And that brings us to the end of Section D for this week. Today's show was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris, and playing you out, a not entirely unpredictable track to close our Brazil special, but certainly one of the most evocative, here's Underwater Love by Smoke City. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye. This must be Underwater Love.